Good afternoon. So, last time, we started by talking about reader-writer locks, and we were looking at a strategy for implementing them using monitors, and we mentioned we have this choice, that there are some times when we wanted to wake up multiple threads which were waiting for different conditions, and in our original implementation, we just let kind of signal and con broadcast decide who gets to run first, and it might not have been the choice that we felt was ideal. But we could be explicit about that choice by adding an extra condition about who goes first to the reasons we wait, and also when we decide to signal or broadcast. And by doing that, we could choose this reader or writer priority. And we mentioned we could also implement other policies that might be useful to us. After we looked at monitors, we went to a more general problem, which we think of as primarily being a thing with locks, like the easiest way of having this problem was locks. But we saw that we had this problem with any time we had something that acted kind of like a lock, where a thread could own a resource and wait for another resource. When we have resources like that, we saw an example of locks, we saw an example of buffers for pipes that work this way, and some other things. We had this bug called deadlock. And in deadlock, everyone was hanging. And we had this sort of formal idea of the conditions for deadlock. So we have mutual exclusion, that we need to have some resource where, at least for each unit of the resource, exactly one thread owns it, that we don't share it between multiple threads, that when you own a resource, you hold and wait for another resource, and that when you're asking for a resource from another thread, you can't just take it away from them like we can with the CPU, for example. You have to actually wait for that thread to be done and voluntarily give it up. And where we had our hanging problem was we had a circular dependency. One thread could be waiting on another thread, which is waiting on the first thread, or some longer chain of dependencies that ends up cycling back around. So we have this definition of deadlock, and this definition helped us figure out how we could resolve deadlock. And our key idea is we looked at each of those conditions of the definition and found a way of making it not hold. And for deadlock that involved locks, our easiest solution was to make the circular dependency part not hold. We still wanted locks to wait for the resource. We still wanted locks to be something that we can acquire while we have another lock. But we wanted some way of avoiding the circular dependency, and we did that by choosing an ordering, and that prevented that cyclic dependency. And we had some other strategies like not holding and waiting. We can just try to get it, and if we don't get it, give up. And various other solutions that fix the deadlock problem. And when we were finishing up, we talked about detecting deadlocks. Now, I first gave you this idea of doing this with a situation where we would be concerned about debugging. That if I have a deadlock, it would be really nice if there were some function in my debugger where I could say, hey, I think I might be deadlocked, tell me what's going on, and identify like this lock, this lock, this lock, this is your problem. These are the things where you need to provide one of our solutions to get rid of those criteria for deadlock. You need to make it so there's no circular dependency, or you need to give up if you can't get the lock, or something like that. And we saw that with locks, we could just construct the graph and use algorithms you may or may not remember from prior classes for finding cycles in a graph. We mentioned, well, you know, that seems great, but it doesn't work in the more general case because we have some resources which don't look like locks where you have them divided into pieces. Like if we have memory, for example, we can have a deadlock if we're waiting for memory. But the deadlock, you know, if we look at the graph, we're gonna have cycles even if there's maybe not really a deadlock, because you know, if three programs are trying to allocate memory right now, well, and those three programs also have memory allocated, those are three, you know, more than three cycles because everyone's using memory, but we really need to look at how much memory is there versus how much is the program allocating, which means that deadlock detection gets more complicated. And we're not going to talk about how you actually implement the more complete deadlock detection, except to say that there is a way of doing it, and if you ever actually need to do it, you should look that up and not just assume you look for cycles. So before I move on today, any questions about the topics we covered last time? Okay, so some little logistical notes. So on the quiz, there's an output about the output of a program with semaphores. I did not write the code I intended to write. We're accepting both the answers for their question as written, where none of the outputs were possible, and the answers if you assumed I corrected that bug, changed that 1 to a 0 or greater than to a greater than equal. So accepted both because of that. Another thing, so office hour wait. So I know there have gotten scattered complaints about office hour time waiting. So there's only so much I can do to make TAs available at the times you seem to want to use office hours. There might be some improvements we can do with queues, maybe, but there's trade-offs, like if we have a queue, we're not gonna have TAs grouping students together if they have the same problem. And people can abuse queues if they're online, maybe differently than in person, which may or may not be good. But we're looking at it. Just to note for you, so I'm aware of this problem, and not all of the office hours are used evenly. Like, I get reports from students and TAs about office hours being really crowded, and this does not reflect my experience at, for example, my office hours. I don't know if I'm scary or giving bad help, but no. And I know this also does not reflect the experience of all the TAs at all the office hour times, which we have many. You don't all have to come at like 7 p.m. on Thursday. So just mentioning that, and yes, I'm aware the situation's not great, but you have a lot of students and only so many TAs available at only so many times. Okay, so going on to picking up where we were last time. So I mentioned problem with divisible resources. So our issue was that, we could produce our graph for deadlock with, in this case, memory, but here we have a cycle because thread 2 is waiting on memory that thread 1 owns, which is waiting on memory that thread 2 owns. We have a cycle, for example, there, but we don't know if that cycle is actually causing a deadlock because there might be enough extra memory. And in this case, there is. It's just not obvious that there's enough extra memory because of this thread 3, but we could have little changes, like if thread 3 was waiting on thread 1, or if we had less memory, it would actually be a deadlock. So we need some other algorithm that does it. It exists. You can look it up. High-level intuition is it simulates what would happen, but we're not going to test you on it because, if you need to implement it, you'll look it up and do it, because you're not just going to guess what it is anyways. But when I talked about deadlock detection, I was giving you sort of the impression that this was a debugging tool, and that is like one of the more practical reasons to use deadlock detection, but there's another, which is that you can do something useful when you detect a deadlock. And deadlock detection does seem hard because you have to instrument where you have deadlocks, and then what do you do with that information besides tell the programmer? But for some applications, this is actually done. And databases are probably the biggest example. So some databases take sort of queries from users, and that means that they can't easily use the consistent order. Because if the user says do A, then do B in one query and says do B, then do A in the other, the natural way of implementing that, you're going to have a lock order problem. So some databases use a solution where you do deadlock detection, and when they detect a deadlock, they have the mechanism to revoke the lock and undo the operation, undo part of the operation and retry it later. Now this requires you have a lot more instrumentation, but this is actually something some programs do in cases where the deadlock prevention solutions are not so practical. So questions on deadlock detection? Okay, so now that we've talked a lot about threads, I'm going to talk about not using threads. And the reason for this is that often we don't actually want to deal with the complications of using threads, like deadlock and race conditions and so on. And I'm going to talk about two different ways of not using threads, but accomplishing many of the goals that might have provoked us into using threads. I'm going to start with something called event-based programming. And this is going to be focused on what I call, when we introduce threads, concurrency. I have one overall task, like running a web server, and I have these multiple things that happen in parallel, like I have multiple web browsers contacting my web server. And a natural way of writing this is I have one thread for each web browser, because they're doing kind of independent things with their own sort of if statements and so on. So it makes sense to write a thread for that. But in a case like this, we can make an observation about like what are threads giving us. They're giving us sort of a convenient programming model, but they're not really likely to be helping our performance that much, because if you think of a web server, like how much stuff can I do with one core? If my website's pretty simple, I can serve, you know, gigabits off one core very easily, and I don't need threads to use multiple cores. Like, if multiple cores like aren't actually going to help me, like I can already saturate my network connection with one core. So we could have this alternate idea where we have one thread that handles multiple connections, and if we do this, well, then we don't have to worry about like race conditions and locking, because there's only one thread. You can't have race conditions, maybe. So on. But there's a problem with this. So one problem is going to be, how do I organize my code? Another problem is, well, if I have my web server talking to multiple web browsers, how do I read from multiple web browsers that are talking to me? We need some way of reading and writing multiple connection streams at once. And this idea of events is going to let us do that. And we're going to suppose that our operating system is going to provide us a tool. We'll talk about a little, very short, quickly about what that might look like, you know, in like real POSIX, but where we're going to get events. So here's my sort of abstract notion of an event, is that I have this special thing that uses a system call that gets the next event, which is the next thing that happens with my input and output. And that's going to tell me things like, hey, you have a new connection, or hey, now you can read some data from one of your web browsers without waiting. So rather than trying to figure out how to read from three different web browsers, I call wait for next event, and it tells me which one I should read from first, and you know, doesn't tell me about the ones where they haven't sent the data yet. Okay, questions about this high-level model? So with this idea, we're going to have this bit of code which handles, you know, being able to read one thing or write one thing, and unlike our single-threaded code, we're going to have some way of going from the event to our information about our connection, in this case, for our web server. And previously, that information would have been stored like in local variables. So like our threaded code might have looked like this. We'd get our file descriptor representing the web browser we're talking to, and we'd say, read a command from the web browser, compute the response, and process it. And in the meanwhile, we're, you know, we have this loop of things where in the loop we're doing things like read and presumably write in here, which are going to wait for something, which is why we want multiple threads. We aren't using multiple threads in this code with code like this in order to really take advantage of multiple cores, probably. We're mainly using it because when we're reading, we want some other copy of this code on a different connection to run, you know, while we're waiting for reading or writing. So what we'll do to convert this to event-based code is we're going to take all the local variables, and because we have this loop where we just do one read, we're going to need to put them in some data structure somewhere. So we're going to have a struct where I have all the information about a connection, to save between different my calls to read and write. And then I'm going to sort of take this code and sort of unloop it. So I'm going to have something which is called to do one read. So that might look like this. So this is just the body of the loop and the termination condition. So we can see here, here's my original code, here's this new code, and we've taken the body of the loop and put it at the beginning. So each time handle read gets called, so which meaning each time that wait for next event tells me, hey, now you can read without waiting. We read once, because we can do that without waiting now. And we do what we do for one read. Then we have our processing for that while loop. And when that condition becomes true, we want to stop reading. So the way I handle that is I tell whatever that wait for next event function, hey, I'm done reading, stop telling you about being able to read. Maybe I won't care about that later, but I don't care about it for now. That's the equivalence of ending that while loop, that where we read, we're not reading anymore. And I compute the response and say, now I want to write, so please tell me about being able to write without waiting. And later on, we'll have a separate handle write function, which will handle using this response I just computed and sending it out to the connection. So questions about the strategy for converting our programs from threaded programs into these not threaded programs? So the idea is now with this new event-based version, we call wait for next event, and we just switch between sort of manually each connection we're processing rather than having threads for each connection, having the OS switch between the threads. And often this is more convenient in the sense that there's no race condition, there's no locks, because there's only one thread, so you don't have to worry about certain types of bugs. And it's often as fast, sometimes faster, because you know, we aren't context switching anymore. And a missing piece is, like, I showed you these sort of notional wait for next event functions at start waiting for read and so on. What do these actually look like? So we're not going to go over the detailed API, but in POSIX there are two functions which you could use to implement wait for next event. They're select and pull. And basically what these functions do is they take a list of file descriptors that you want to read and or write, and they return which ones can we read and write right now, waiting if none of them we can read and write until one of them is readable or writable. And that would be how you implement wait for next event. And by readable or writable, I mean that you can read without waiting or write without waiting, meaning that there's some buffer space that you can fill immediately. Okay. And many OSs have extensions or alternatives to this, so there's lots of versions of this API in practice so for supporting writing programs in this way. So questions about events? Yeah?
Without waiting, are you referring to like without blocking the thread?
The question without waiting, am I referring to without blocking? Yes. So without, like, meaning that the system call will complete without setting the thread as not runnable. Like, the thread might still be set at not runnable for, like, exceeding its time quantum, but not because there's, like, no buffer space. Okay. Other questions? Yeah?
Can you make the second line under select and pull, like, wait for them to be read, writable, without waiting?
Waiting for them to be readable or writable without waiting, depending on which, how you specify them in the argument. So you can say, I want to read from this file descriptor, and pull will return when you can call read, and it will return right away with something. Or you say, I want to write to this file descriptor, and pull or will return telling you when you can call write in a particular way, and it will actually write something and not block. It does turn out, as a detail I didn't mention, that you need to call write in a way where you say, hey, if I use all my buffer space, stop. But you can, there's a way to do that in POSIX. Okay, other questions? Okay, so that this model was doing for programs where we didn't actually care about using multiple cores, but we wanted something that still allowed sort of us to handle multiple flows of I/O at the same time. So another model, which comes up more often when we actually care about using multiple cores to do more computation, is message passing. And as the name suggests, the idea is rather than sharing variables between threads, like either like directly as a global variable or indirectly through pointers, we're going to pass messages between threads. And that's going to be how we communicate. And this means our threads could be separate processes. And one reason this is popular is that this is what you need at a large scale. If you want to run things on multiple machines that are working together, well, it's probably not going to be efficient to have them share memory. And in fact, most supercomputers for like the past 20 years don't share memory between different parts of the supercomputer. They're actually a bunch of separate computers put together. So if you want to do something across the whole supercomputer, this is the programming model you'll typically use because you can't actually have a global variable that everyone can read and write. And arguably, it's an easier model to program because you don't need to think about locking issues. I say arguably because like there's certainly some extra steps in thinking about how do I use messages well. And the idea of the message passing is that you'll have a send function and a receive function, which will take an ID of a thread or a process. So here in this example, I've decided that thread 0 is going to send to every other thread some work as a message and then receive the result. And the threads will do the work in between the send and receive, presumably. And the other threads receive the work, compute the result, send the result back. So questions on? So this looks like a kind of abstract example. So let's be very specific about how you might use this and talk about doing this for the Life program. So we did multi-threaded version of Life where we had a grid and we just divided up between threads. And here's one possible way of dividing up between, in this case, threads. I label those processes because they aren't going to share memory. And might be very similar to what you did. And rather than having a single piece of shared memory containing the whole grid, I'm just going to have each process store the cells they're responsible for computing. Now, this works except if you remember how we computed cells, we needed all the cells around it. So for example, process 3 here needs the cells it's computing and a little sliver around that. So to solve this with message passing, we need some way of getting process 3 information about what was computed by process 2 and process 4 on that little sliver. And a way we can do that is we can just have process 2 send a message to process 3 with this little sliver, and process 4 send a message with its little sliver. And this sort of thing is why message passing is maybe more efficient than it might look like compared to shared memory. So you might have said, well, of course we need to share the whole grid. That's going to be much faster than if we have to copy parts of the grid between different threads. But what we have to copy to send our messages is actually this little piece. And that's not actually a big deal to copy that little piece, even if we aren't sharing the memory, even if we can't just have a pointer to that data directly. And so a typical message passing implementation will have these two processes send that information to process 3. And process 3, conversely, will send its sliver to process 2 and 4, its two slivers. Okay, so questions about this model? Okay. And I'm mentioning these alternate programming models because quite often, like you'll see a problem where you want to use threads, and maybe threads aren't the right solution. You're just gonna spend too much time dealing with like nasty concurrency bugs like you may have come across for Life or Pool, when you could just avoid them by choosing a different sort of design pattern and still get what the benefits you were hoping to get from threads. Okay, so that's what I have on alternate threading models. So questions about message passing? Yeah. So the question is, do I have to forward values between threads? Like that's what we're talking about doing, but we have this convenient, in the life example, we have steps, which I think is, you're worried about like not having that sort of, precise nature of sharing. So you might have to communicate more frequently than you'd like, but, you have the same kind of question with just using threads and shared memory, because if thread one needs the value that thread three computed, you need to answer the question, how do I make sure thread three reads that value after thread one computes it? And the same way you answer that question with threads is how you're gonna answer, how do I make sure that thread one sends the value to thread three by the time it needs it? Does that answer your question? Yep. Okay. So, other things on message passing. Okay, so our next topic is gonna be about virtual memory, and I have to talk about prerequisites. So, there are three different prerequisites for this class. So there's 3330 or COA 2, the prereq taken by computer science majors, depending on whether you're in the pilot or not. And in both of those classes, virtual memory is covered for several days. And there's also computer engineering majors, and the prereq listed in the course catalog for this class is the embedded class in ECE. Now you might think, if you know a little about the ECE curriculum, you might say, there's an ECE architecture course, why isn't that the prereq? I don't know, it isn't. It's actually the embedded class. And you might, now we're covering virtual memory. Virtual memory is sort of one of the topics alluded to by the catalog description of operating systems. And my understanding is that the CPE embedded and architecture course have very little coverage on it. So this is an unfortunate disconnect between the preparation of our CS students and our CPE students. So I'm going to be doing more of a review of virtual memory than I would do if I could just assume you've taken COA 2 and/or 3330 and you know it. But I know CPE students are not the majority of the class by a long stretch, so like, I'm sorry, I have to like find some middle point. So we're going to talk about reviewing how virtual memory works, which should be useful for everyone because my recollection from prior semesters is that people who've taken 3330, where I know we've done like 4 days of virtual memories, often don't have the greatest recall of that. So it's worth reviewing, at least some. Yeah?
Is it on the exam?
Is it on the exam? So everything up until Thursday is on the midterm, if that's what you're asking, and the quiz for this week. Other questions? Okay. So let's give our high level overview, starting with our motivation. So we alluded to address translation, that we have these processes. We talked about how we isolate the compute time for the processes, but we also have to have them have separate memory. And the mechanism for that is that the addresses the program uses go through this mapping that the hardware implements that translates the addresses they use, and I mean all the addresses. So if they call a function, if they access something on their stack, if they access a global variable, all goes through this mapping, no exceptions. So whenever the program is running, it goes through this mapping in the hardware. And this means that these two programs here, A and B, can't access each other's memory because there's no way to go through this mapping and for program A to get to program B's data. It also means that we can arrange for two programs to have the same address mean a different thing. So if you vaguely remember how we talked about the layout of a program in 2150 or other prior classes, we sort of said the stack is at this place near the top of memory, and we can make that the same for all programs, and that's fine because all programs are going to look at this mapping to figure out where their stack really is. So we can have two programs running at the same time where their memory is actually in two different locations. So we're going to talk about virtual memory, which is all going to be about like what does this mapping look like and what does that let us as an operating system designer do to run programs in maybe more efficient or provide useful interfaces to the programs. So I'm going to start with a toy example of how this address translation works to give a particular design for this mapping, which is going to be the one that we call virtual memory. And for my toy example, I'm going to say we have a program with this 10-bit address space. So it has addresses 000 to 3FF in hexadecimal. So 10-bit addresses. And we're going to divide up its addresses into three regions. We're going to have its code in the bottom fourth, its data like global variables and the beginning of its heap, and the second fourth. We're going to have space for more heap, but initially empty in the third fourth, and then its stack. So this is just a layout I've chosen arbitrarily. And I have these, you know, I divided this memory into four pieces. I'm just going to call each of these pieces a virtual page. So I'll use the term virtual to refer to addresses that the program is accessing. And we'll call addresses that are after the mapping, the ones on the actual hardware, you know, that in the memory system that we deal with, like when we talk about the memory bus, I'll call physical. And in this division, I'm dividing the addresses up into what I call pages, and I've chosen a size for those pages. And not coincidentally, I've chosen a size that is a power of 2. So in this case, 2 to the 8 bytes. And I've decided to number these pages, starting with the lowest address at 0, going up to, in this case, 3. So there's a good reason why I've chosen to divide the memory into a power of 2 unit, and that's that it's going to be really easy to go from an address to this number. If we think of, you know, I know we have size 2 to the 8, how do I get which of those units I'm in? I take my address, I divide by 2 to the 8. Dividing by a power of 2 is just chopping off the lower bits. So this means that these page numbers I wrote down are just the high bits of the address. And this is convenient for the hardware because the hardware needs to implement the mapping, and we're going to take advantage of this to make that efficient in the hardware. And it's convenient for the operating system because in the operating system, we're often going to need to take an address that the program gave us and look up this page number. And now we can do this by doing some bit shifting. Now, we're going to call this these top bits the page number. And we're going to call the rest of the address the page offset. The name page offset comes because this is where in these divisions of the memory it is. So offset 0 is at the beginning of one of these pages. Offset 80 is right in the middle. Offset, you know, FE is just before the end. So the page offset says how far into one of these pages are you? So questions about how I divided this up. So the reason we're dividing up the program's memory into these pages, these virtual pages, is that this is the unit at which that mapping is going to operate. So we're going to take our program's memory as these virtual addresses split up into pages, and we're also going to take our physical addresses and split them up into pages. In my toy example, my physical addresses have a bigger range, so we have more physical addresses than the program can ever access. In real systems, you might have more or less or the same. And what we're going to do is we're going to say that we have these physical addresses, we're going to split it up into units of the same size, and we're going to number those the same way. So I have 0, 1, all the way up, in this case, to 7. Which I've numbered by just saying the lowest address is 0, next one is 1, and so on. And to make my mapping, I'm just going to assign these virtual pages to these physical pages. So I'm just going to draw some lines saying, okay, this virtual page 0 goes to physical page 2, this virtual page 1 goes to physical page 7, and so on. Now, when we're thinking of having our OS tell the processor this mapping, we're not going to draw a picture. The processor is not very good at understanding pictures. So we're going to represent this in a way which is a bit closer to what the processor deals with. So we'll have a table, which you may have heard of called a page table. And the table is going to have an entry for each virtual page. And we're going to store, at the least, what physical page it corresponds to. Now, one thing about this table is that we're often going to have entries where we don't actually want a mapping. So in the case of my example, I told you we had space for the heap to expand to, but it was initially empty. When it's empty, we're not going to allocate anything for it. We're just going to have it mapped to nothing. And that's going to be something that this table supports. Some questions. This. So this table form is closer to things that the processor might be able to understand, but we actually need to represent this as a bunch of bits. So we're gonna need to deal with this none entry. I can't just put none and numbers. That's not a thing the hardware supports. I need to put bits into the hardware. So what we're going to do to handle the none case is we're going to add this valid bit. So valid bit is going to be 1 for each of the virtual pages which actually have a mapping, and 0 to represent none. And then we're going to have other bits for the physical page number. And this is going to be our actual page table that we're going to store somewhere. The operating system is going to set this, and the processor is going to read it. And when the processor reads it, it takes our address from the program, and it's going to divide that up into the page offset and the virtual page number. It's going to take the row corresponding to the virtual page number, and it's going to get out the valid bit and the actual physical page number. It's going to take the physical page number and add it back to the page offset. So if we're, you know, just near the beginning of the page, we want virtual page, we want to be just near the beginning of the physical page. If we're just near the end of the virtual page, we want to be just near the end of the physical page. So the page offset stays the same. We just use this table lookup to replace the page number part to go from our virtual page number to the physical page number the operating system chose for us. And the other thing we're going to do as part of this is that we're going to check the valid bit, and if it's 0, we're going to trigger an exception. And this exception is going to be called a page fault. And when that exception happens, the OS runs its exception handler. One thing you've probably seen that exception handler doing is when you access memory that you don't have allocated, it might have the corresponding entry be invalid in the page table, and sometimes your OS caused the system to eventually output segmentation fault. That's one possible thing that exception handler could do. So in this picture, we have some components that we're going to talk about a bunch. So one of them is the particular row we look up. We're going to call that a page table entry. I'll sometimes abbreviate that PTE. We have a virtual page number in our virtual address, which converts to a physical page number, and we have a page offset, which is the name we use regardless of whether it's in the virtual or the physical address. And our address from the CPU, this is our virtual address, and our address that we actually send to the cache is our physical address. So questions about this lookup? Okay, so now we know that. Let's do a little exercise. And I gave my toy example. Let's go back to the sizes that XV6 uses. So XV6 runs in 32-bit x86. In its most common configuration, it's going to have 4,096 byte pages, or 2 to the 12 bytes. So given that, here's a virtual address. And I want you to tell me what's the virtual page number in the address, and what's the page offset. And suppose we looked up this virtual address in the page table, and the page table entry we looked up had this physical page number of 998 in hex. I want to know what's the physical address that will come as a result of that lookup, the actual address we'll access. Give you a minute, you can check with your neighbor if you agree. Okay, who would like more time? Okay. So we have pages which are 2 to the 12 bytes. And to figure out the page number, we're going to divide by 2 to the 12. Dividing by 2 to the 12 means taking off the last 12 bits. And one way you could do this is by taking that virtual address, writing it out in binary, carefully removing the last 12 bits, and then converting it back to something more readable. But we could also remember that in hexadecimal, each radix represents 4 bits. So 12 bits is 4 times 3. So the page offset is the last 3 bits. That's what we get taken off when we divide by 2 to the 12. And everything else is the virtual page number. So questions? So as for the physical page, we're going to take our 12-bit page offset and put it at the end after this physical page number, since that's 12 bits is a multiple of 4 again, I can just do this with hex digits. If it wasn't, I need to like do it in binary and then figure out how to convert back to hex if I wanted to do that. So we have 9, 9, 8, 1, 2, 3. So I have my 12-bit page offset and my physical page number that make up the physical address. Another way of looking at it is I get the beginning of the page by multiplying by 2 to the 12. That adds 3 zeros in hex, and I add that to the page offset. Another way of thinking about it. Yes? So the virtual page number. So remember that when we talked about page numbers, we thought that if we divided by the size of a page, we got the index starting with 0. So if I take OX, A, B, C, D, 0, 1, 2, 3, divided by 2 to the 12th, that's just taking off the last 12 bits, just like if I was writing my 10 to the 3rd, we take off the last 3 decimal digits. So that's what I'm doing by just taking off bits. Another way of thinking about it is that we know that since there's 2 to the 12 places in the page, we need 12 bits to not represent where in the page we are. So our address has 12 bits of a page offset, and everything else is the virtual page number. This is our virtual address because of how we split up addresses. That's another way of looking at it. Questions? Yeah.
So this 32-bit x86 dictate the virtual address size, or does it also affect the physical address size?
So the question is, does 32-bit x86 dictate the virtual and or physical address size? So it dictates the virtual address size. The name 32-bit comes from the virtual address size. The processor also dictates the physical address size because it's going to decide on what the format of the page tables are.
So how big could the physical address be in this case?
So 32-bit x86, as used by XV6, makes the physical addresses 32 bits. There is a mode 32-bit x86 can work in where the physical addresses are larger that we won't talk about, but it does exist. And that sort of thing happens with processors, is that there's multiple answers for how big are the physical addresses. Okay. So talk about sort of our table lookup. And you might say, okay, so here's how the page table must work. We have an entry for every virtual page. And you know, from 00000 hex to FFFFF hex, because we have, with a 32-bit virtual address, we have a 12-bit page offset and therefore a 20-bit virtual page number. So we have 2 to the 20 entries, it looks like, but that's really big. And that's kind of a problem. That's actually pretty hard to store. 2 to the 20 entries, and typically each of these entries is going to be 4 bytes, so that's 4 meg for every program that's not storing data. So that's not actually acceptable, so we're not going to do that. And this problem's way worse on a 64-bit system, where you want to have like 2 to the 40 entries or something like that, and that just completely doesn't work out. Also, so we'll talk about how we fix that in a bit. Something I want to point out, so we talked about there being a valid bit. There's typically also going to be some other metadata bits in the page table entries. So here we have a read and write OK. We'll talk about what's really in XV6 later. But these are things that the processor is going to check. So for example, if there's a write OK, the processor is going to check when it gets the physical address. It's going to check, did I get this physical address from a page table entry that was marked as write OK? If so, that's great. Otherwise, trigger an exception, tell the OS, hey, you told me the program shouldn't write here, but it did. It tried to. We'll talk about that more later. Now, how do we store this huge page table? So we're going to use two different strategies to mitigate this. So one thing is that we can't fit this on the processor. We don't have 4 megs of RAM lying around on the chip. You know, and if we had a fast 4 megs of RAM, we'd use it for cache. So rather than storing these page tables. The other thing is that we don't want to actually store the whole page table. And what we're going to observe is that most programs have lots of invalid page table entries. For example, when I start a new program and I could allocate a gigabyte, I haven't. So there's a gigabyte of pages that aren't valid. And we don't want to store those. And we're going to avoid storing those by using a tree-type data structure where we can omit parts of the tree that are all invalid. So I'm going to talk about what the version of x86 page tables XP6 uses look like. And they have a two-level tree structure. So there are 2 to the 20 virtual pages in total. And they divide this into two levels. And at each level, we have tables with 2 to the 10 entries. So we have a first level table, which contains an array of 2 to the 10 entries. And it points to second level tables, which also contain arrays of 2 to the 10 entries. And the reason that this is going to save space is that when we have regions of memory that aren't allocated, we're just going to have the first level entries of those tables be marked as not valid. So rather than having a pointer to a second level, we'll just say, there's nothing here. And this is where we're saving space. We're not allocating the whole second level table and all those page table entries for it. And because this represents a lot of the program's memory, we hope that's going to save a bunch of space. So with the scheme, our first level table, we're going to have, it's going to be an array of these entries, and each element of this array is going to represent a big range of virtual page numbers. We're going to have a valid bit because we can have holes, and we're going to have a physical page number. But rather than being a physical page number we'll use to construct the final address, it's just the physical page number of the second level. Okay. And then at the second level, we're going to get a page table, and it's not going to start at virtual page number 0. It's going to start somewhere in the middle, because it's going to start based on what entry we got in the first level to point to it. So in this case, I'm saying we looked at this page table entry here. So we have a table which is C00 through FFFF, because that's the range it corresponded to in the first level table. And then we'll use the entry we get here, and the physical page number we have here will actually tell us where the program should be accessing. So questions about this two-level structure? Okay. So something I have to know about this two-level idea is naming. And this is partly because, you know, there's naming that you may have seen and naming that XP6 uses. And, you know, I want to make sure we're consistent. So there's a base pointer. So I have this table I set in memory. So something I didn't show you is that the OS needs to say where this table is. So there's a page table base pointer in CPU. And this is what the OS sets. It says, hey, processor, here's where the page table is in memory. And that points to what I just called a first level page table. You might also see it called a top level page table. Or if you're reading Intel's documentation or XP6 source code, the page directory. I don't think that's a good name, but it's what Intel chose. And then its entries point to the next table, which I've called the second level page table, XP6 and Intel. Sometimes call this the page table, because they call the first level the page directory. I think this was a bad choice by Intel, and an especially bad choice because they have in 64-bit x86, there's 4 levels, and there's a page directory. This doesn't scale, and they still did it. But just want you to be aware, I'm going to try to use the term first level and second level, but XP6 source code might be different. And Intel manuals will be different. So in 32-bit x86, they have this two-level scheme. And the page tables at each level, the first and second level, have 4-byte page table entries, always stored in memory. So each of the page tables is an array of 4-byte values. And the first 10 bits get the index into the first array, and the second 10 bits get the index into the second array. So it's a 2-level lookup. We use the first 10 bits of the address, the first half of the virtual page number for the first array. We find where the second array is. We use the second 10 bits to look up in that. And then we have 12 bits left over in our 32-bit address. That's the page offset. That's where in the final page number we find is the program's actual data. So questions? So after the midterm, we'll be doing some programming that involves manipulating these. And XV6 needs to do this quite a bit. It needs to manipulate page table entries and find them. So it has some macros for precisely this translation. It has a PDX macro, which just does the bit shifting to extract what it calls the page directory index, the index into the first level table. And it has a PTX macro to extract the index into the second level table, what it call, they call the page table index. And they also have this macro here for constructing a virtual address from the directory index, the table index, and the offset. Just taking advantage of how the address is split up. And because the address is split up like this, this is another view that might help you think about these two-level tables. So here, I have my base register that's stored in the processor, points to the first level table, which is indexed with the first part of the virtual page number. That points to the second level table, which is indexed with the second part of the virtual page number. And that points to the actual page where the program's data is, which is indexed with the page offset. Questions? OK, so let's do a little exercise now that we talked about how XV6's page tables work. So here I have virtual address 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 in hex. And I'm saying my base pointer, so this is the location of my first level table. So this is the byte address of the first level table is 1000 hex. And I'm telling you that when we look up this address, the page table entry you find in the first level contains physical page number 14 hex. So if it's physical page number 14, that means it's that means that the first byte of that page is at address hex 14 times the size of a page, right? Because address physical page 0 starts at address 0. Physical page 1 doesn't start at address 1 byte. Just like if I give you an array and I say, where's entry 0 is at the start of the array, where's entry 1? You're going to ask me what's the size of the things in the array. So these are treating memory as an array of pages. Those are the indexes, those page numbers. So I'm telling you the first level, we get 14. At the second level, we look up and get 15. So the first question is, what's the address of the first level PTE? And you can think of, why would I want to know this? Well, one reason, in an OS, if I want to set the first level page table entry to something else, you need to know where it is. So let's do that computation. And then what's the address of the second level page table entry? Give you a minute or two. Check with your neighbor. Figure out how to do this. Who would like some more time? Okay. Okay, so we still want a little more time? Okay, so I'll start it in how I approach this. So I want to figure out where we're looking things up, so I want to figure out the indexes we're looking up with. So that means I need to take advantage of that there's part of the address. So I want to divide up the address into our page offset, and the two 10-bit regions we use to look at in the first and the second level. So we have a 10 bits for the first level, 10 bits for the second level, 12 bits for the virtual page number, so not for the page offset, and the rest is the virtual page number split up. So our page offset is the last 12 bits, which we learned was in this last three hex rated, so 6, 7, 8. Then I need to get the rest, and unfortunately, these are 10 bits, so we can't just look up the hexadecimal and write it down. So one thing you could do is you could say, okay, I'm going to write this hexadecimal number as binary, then find the binary digits. So I write out 1 is 0001, 2 is 0010, and I got the first 10 bits are going to be these bits, which is going to be, that's an 8 and a 4, if we read that as that binary number, so we get 0x48 here, and the other part, next part, turns out to be using the same method, 0x345. It's just using the binary to do that to extract those 10 bits. And I know my first level lookup is going to use 0x48. So that's going to go in the using this base pointer, or what I using colors. So using this base pointer, I'm going to go to entry 0x48. Now, if the index was 0, it would be at, so you know, index 0 is at 0x1000. How about index, this is 0 index, 1 index. Well, this is an array of page table entries. If I ask you, I have an array of ints, and I ask, where is index 10 in the array of ints? You don't tell me byte 10, because it's an array of ints. Ints are more than one byte. It's 10 times the size of an int. And we're going to do the same thing here. Our page table entries are 4 bytes. So index 1 would be at 0x1004. And to get this new address, we're going to take our base address and add 4 times the index, 0x48, and get 0x1120, which I computed with a calculator elsewhere because I don't trust myself to do that in my head. So questions about how I did that and why I'm multiplying by 4. Okay, so then I need to worry about my second level. So I need to figure out what's the base address for the second level. And I have the base address as a page number here. In my first level, this is what I found, 0x14. But that's a page number. So I need to add, take into account how big our page is. Because if I got page number 1, that's not an address 1. That's address 1 times the size of a page. Got page number 0, it's address 0. Page number 2 is address 2 times the size of a page. Here it's 0x14 times the size of a page. So 0x14 times 2 to the 12th. Or just add 12 zeros in binary. So that's 0x14000 is the first byte of that page. So that's where our array, that's our second level table, starts. So we're going to have that base address, and we're going to do the same calculation, that the index into the array is 345, and we're going to multiply that times 4, because that's not in bytes, that's in page table entries. And when we do that multiplication, which I'm going to use a calculator for because I sure don't do that correctly in my head, we're going to get 0x14d14, d14. And I conveniently drew a line across it. Okay, that's great. 14d4. Okay, so questions about how I do that? Yes?
Why are we multiplying by 4?
We're multiplying by 4 because this is an array of page table entries, but my addresses are in bytes. So if I want to advance to the next page table entry, I need to add 4, but our index will only increase by 1. Yeah.
Sorry, what does that say? Is that 14D14?
Oh, 14D14, yes. Maybe if I write it as a capital D, then I'm worried about that looking like a 0.
When you say address of first level PTE and address of second level PTE, is it virtual or physical?
So the question is the address, are these virtual or physical? These are both physical addresses. And we know they're physical addresses because until we do the final step of our page table lookup, we always deal with physical, deal with physical addresses actually from the beginning, right? Because our page table, we can't look up a virtual address in our page table because we're using a virtual address to look it up, and we have this recursion problem. We're not going to do that. Okay, answer your question. Okay. And one thing we didn't ask, but that you can figure out from this information, is we have our virtual address. We also know the corresponding physical address. We're going to use this last part. This last page table entry gets us that. So the corresponding physical address is 0x15678, because we copy the page offset, add it with the physical page number we got at the last step. Okay, so questions? This procedure. Okay, so I'll go through this quickly. We're a little short on time. So question here is, so we know how the page tables work. How big are they? So let's take the simplest case. If we have one valid 4K page, what's in our page table? We have several page tables. So we have a base pointer. And the base pointer points to a first level table. What's in that first level table if we have one valid page? So there's one page the program can access. What do we put in our first level table to make that happen? So we have a bunch of page table entries. Are any of them valid? Some people are shaking their head. Anyone? So one of them is going to be valid, and we only need one. What's going to be in the valid page table entry at the first level? No volunteers. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so we have two levels, so it's going to point to a second level page table. Okay. And at the second level, we say we have one page that's valid that the program can access. For that to happen, there needs to be a pointer in one of the second level tables, so we'll put it here. So this points to the data. And each of these page tables is 4K because we have 10 bits, so 2 to the 10 entries, times 4 bytes is 4 kilobytes. So this is 4 kilobytes, and this is 4 kilobytes. So we have 8 kilobytes to point to that one page. How about if we had all the pages occupied? Then we'd have this situation where we want every entry in the first level. When the processor looks it up, it needs to find something. And assuming we don't allow duplicates, that means that in this second scenario, we are going to have our base pointer point to a 4K page where each entry points to a different second level. So we have 2 to the 10 of these, second level. That's 1K. So we end up with 1,025. So this is 1 plus 1,024 times 4K, the size of each of the tables. So questions? This. Okay, and so one last thing I'll just say, talk briefly in our last 30 seconds. So we're going to talk next time about how XV6 sets up page tables. And to do that, we'll first talk about how it lays out memory. So like most many OSs, XV6 divides the memory between kernel and user. And the page table has entries for the kernel, which is the blue part. And XV6 does something you might find a little strange, but that's actually very common. The kernel part of memory is mapped 1-to-1, meaning that starting at that line labeled kern base, it's just physical address 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to the end of physical memory. And the green part, which is what user programs use, is not mapped that way. So the reason the kernel is mapped that way is this is going to be convenient for manipulating page tables, and we'll see how that's used next time. Talk more about this.